Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here. I want to take you from a drizzly November morning in London to somewhere that's even bleaker and even colder. Not to space, but to Antarctica. Specifically, Antarctica in the winter of 1911, where these three men, Birdie Bowers, Bill Wilson, and Apsley Cherry Garrard, they're members of Captain Robert Falcon Scott's Terra Nova expedition, and they're about to set off on a five-week journey that's going to test them to the very limits of their physical and psychological endurance. So it's dark 24 hours a day. It's bitterly, bitterly cold, temperatures often reaching minus 60 Celsius. Antarctica is one of the most extreme examples of an extreme environment. It's a place where no human can survive without significant technological, physical, and psychological adaptation. So they set off into the unknown on this brutal journey. They're dragging two heavy sledges. You can see them just about in that photo there, each of them weighing about 340 kilos, being dragged over rough rock and ice and through the snow. Every so often, one of these men disappears into a crevasse and has to be hauled out. It's so cold that their teeth crack. Their fingers freeze as soon as they take off their wooden gloves, woolen gloves. And if one of them absentmindedly touches one of the sledge runners, the metal sledge runners, they get agonising blisters. And Cherry Garrard later wrote that sometimes they felt like howling with the pain. It took them hours to set up camp each night, often trying to pitch a tent in blizzard conditions. They had a dinner of fatty meat paste and then spent an hour chipping ice off their sleeping bags. They then tried to sleep, but the cold was so intense that they were frostbitten even when they were inside their sleeping bags. So the next morning they get up early, unrefreshed, for another day of hard marching. And whilst they're walking, sometimes they only realise they've fallen asleep when they stumble and wake up. And here they are when they get back 5 weeks later, looking, I think, remarkably well for their ordeal. But they've endured 35 days of some of the worst conditions faced by any human before or since. And when Cherry Garrard wrote a book about it later, he called it the worst journey in the world. So there's three things that I want us to take from this story. The first is that I think most of us would agree that these men are brave. So studies have shown that around the world, most of us have an intuitive sense of what a brave act is. We kind of know it when we see it. But it's also the subject of considerable research attention, scientific research. And I'm going to talk about some of that in a moment. The second point I want you to take is that these men were not superhuman. In fact, they're pretty ordinary. So of the three of them, Birdie Bowers, over on this side, he's probably the only one you might think of as having the right stuff. So he's a very well-travelled Navy man, hunger for exploration, passion for adventure, hard-working, optimistic, modest, just the sort of person you'd want on your team. But the other two you probably wouldn't mark out as being great polar explorers. So Bill Wilson was a doctor, he was a naturalist, a botanist, and studied natural history. As a young man, he contracted tuberculosis, which left him with deeply scarred lungs. And yet, not only did he survive this expedition, he'd also been on a previous polar expedition where he'd been on a 960-mile trek across the Antarctic continent. And the summer, the Antarctic summer after this winter journey I've just described, he, along with Bowers, was one of five men who went to the South Pole with Robert Falcon Scott, and as history tells us, perished on the return. As for Cherry Garrard, well, he came from a military family. His father was a major general, and he was raised on stories of adventure. But he himself wasn't a bold, brash adventurer. He was a quiet person, a shy person, and according to his biographer, he was deemed too neurotic to join the army. So these are fundamentally ordinary people doing something extraordinarily brave, and that's not unusual. So in my research, studying and talking to people who've gone on these kind of extreme expeditions, what I found was that most of them come from fairly ordinary backgrounds. And when I started looking at the kind of abilities that you need to survive and thrive in these environments, I found that these abilities, including the capacity to be brave, are not qualitatively different from those that most of us have or could potentially develop. The third point I want to take from this story is that motivation is everything. So some of you may know the story, so you'll know why they went. But if you don't know the story, can you think of any good reason why you would put yourself through this? Well, the answer, appropriately enough, given that we're in the Science Museum today, is scientific discovery. Their mission was to collect penguin eggs, which Dr. Wilson was keen to study. So they did it for science. It wasn't for the adrenaline rush, and it wasn't for personal glory. Cherry Garrard later described it as the weirdest bird's nesting expedition there has ever been or ever will be. So let's think about some of these points in a little bit more detail. Let's start off with the definition of bravery. So from the Greek philosophers to modern day psychologists, physiologists and neuroscientists, many scholars have sought to understand what it is that makes us afraid and what it is that makes us courageous. There are a lot of scientific definitions out there, but they kind of share, all of them share these 6 points here. So first of all, it's voluntary. It's a choice to be brave. Secondly, it's active. It's usually doing something, but sometimes it's actively not doing something. The act itself is risky or dangerous, and that risk can take many forms. It could be personal, physical risk, but it also could be risk to your sense of self, to your reputation, or to your place in a group. The outcome is uncertain, kind of goes with it being a risk. And the act is performed despite fear. So there's a common misconception that people who are brave are fearless. They're not. People who are brave feel fear and then they act anyway. And finally, the act has some kind of goal that's valued. This is Beth French. Beth is an endurance swimmer. Her brave acts are undertaking open ocean swims. So she's out there quite often for 24 hours at a time, non-stop swimming. She's risking hypothermia, physical pain, exhaustion from fighting those currents. She's risking jellyfish stings. And in one particularly terrifying episode in Hawaii, she risked being menaced by a shark. Now, Beth spent her adolescent years suffering from an immune dysfunction, and by 17, she was in a wheelchair, and yet here she is 20 years later, fighting back through being brave. And this year, she took on something called the Ocean 7 Challenge. It's swimming the 7 toughest ocean channels. So that includes the Cook Strait in New Zealand, the Molokai Channel in Hawaii, the Straits of Gibraltar, and so on. And she was aiming to do all 7 in 1 year. She'd have been the first person ever to achieve that. And she'd done 4, and she was on track to succeed. And halfway through her 5th swim, she gave up. Now, she was being filmed for a documentary. She had lots of sponsors. She had loads of social media interest, thousands of supporters cheering her on. So that decision to stop was a huge risk for her. It was a risk to her reputation, and it was a risk to her financial security. This woman is a single mum, self-employed. But she did it for a valued goal. So she did it because her autistic son was getting stressed in the build-up to some of her swims, and she didn't want to risk putting him through any more of that, so she gave up. Sometimes not acting, sometimes stopping, is the braver act. Given that fear, uncertainty, and risk are so central to understanding bravery, I thought I'd give you a little bit of science, fear science 101. So the first thing to say is that fear is not a bad thing in itself. It's only bad when it stops us doing things that we could achieve. It's our early warning sign. It keeps us safe. We're built to be afraid because that protects us. And most people I've spoken to go out into extreme environments will say that fear is their friend. But fear has 3 components. It has a component about what you feel, what you think, and what you do. So what you feel is that physical component, the physiological effects, the sweaty palms, the racing heart, the rapid breathing, the churning guts, or butterflies in the stomach if you want to be genteel about it. All those kind of physical reactions that prepare you to run away and escape the danger, or if you have to stand and fight it. What you think is the cognitive component, those thoughts. And when you're facing a fear-inducing situation, sometimes those thoughts are quite useful. So what exactly is the danger? Where is it? How can I get out of it? What can I do about it? Some of those thoughts, though, aren't very useful. They're the little demons in your head that are saying, I'm going to fail, I'm going to let everyone down, we're going to lose everything, we're all going to die. Not very helpful thoughts. And then what you do is the behavioural component, running away or hiding. And the fascinating thing about fear is that all these components are linked. So if you trigger one of them, you tend to trigger the others as well. So if you start ruminating about a fear-inducing situation, particularly if those thoughts are all about how you might not be able to cope with it, you start to get physical symptoms. So the butterflies in your stomach before you go on to do a big talk, for example. If you get the physical effects, so without apparent reason, so you find yourself struggling to breathe, short of breath, or your pulse is racing and you don't know why, that tends to trigger fearful thoughts and panicky thoughts. And that's how panic attacks happen. They kind of reinforce each other. And if you're having fearful thoughts or those physical signs, that's usually accompanied by an intense urge to hide or run away, regardless of whether danger is actually imminent. So these three elements are linked, but they can also be uncoupled. And we do that consciously when we're being brave. So we experience the cognitive effects, we experience the physical effects, but we choose not to act on that urge to hide or run away. Knowing that they're linked, or can be linked, also helps us to manage our fear. That's why you do breathing exercises to calm your nerves. So you calm your physical symptoms and your thoughts start to calm. If you calm your thoughts, your physical sensations start to fade. And this is particularly useful to know as we're getting towards a situation that is inducing fear in us. Anticipatory fear is really common, and it's one of the big obstacles to being brave. Many of the people I spoke to and studied talked about the anxiety that and fears that they feel in the run-up to going into an extreme environment, afraid of death or serious injury, but also afraid of things that might stop them reaching their goal, afraid of finding themselves paralysed with fear and losing their courage, fear of letting themselves down, letting their team down. But what's really interesting is that once they start acting, their fear tends to fade away. So it's the anticipation that's the worst. And once we start the activity that we fear, the fear often dissipates. And that's because our brains can be occupied with the practicalities of getting on with the job instead of ruminating and catastrophizing on all the what-ifs. So the importance of the cognitive dimensions summed up really nicely in this quote from Charles Carroll Everett, there sitting bravely in his library reading a book. So he talked about cowardice as seeing danger where there isn't any. But what's interesting here is he's talking about recklessness. The reckless person doesn't see danger where it actually exists. So they underestimate the danger or they overestimate their ability to cope. The really brave person doesn't overlook the danger, but he doesn't let his mind dwell on it. So as I said, not ruminating on it. But the interesting thing about this quote, I think, is where he says, if it exists, he knows exactly what it is. And this shows us another route to bravery through that thinking, that cognitive component. And that's by reducing uncertainty about the risky or dangerous situation and reducing uncertainty about our own ability to cope with that risky situation. So here is one of the world's best known climbers, Alex Honnold. Some of you may have seen this video before. He's doing something that most of us would find utterly, utterly terrifying. He is on a 500-metre rock face in Mexico, and he's climbing, as you see, without a rope. So is he reckless? This is the question. Well, the dangers are incredibly real. He just needs to miss one step or have one of those little holes, one of those little bits of rock loosen, and it's certain death. But he's climbed his entire life. It's pretty much all he does, day in, day out. He's got a very high ability, and he also has strong confidence in his ability. That's something that psychologists call self-efficacy. It's the belief that we have that we can do something, and that reduces the uncertainty about our response to the fear situation. And for each big climb that he does without ropes, he climbs it first with ropes to familiarise himself with all those holes. So he reduces uncertainty about the situation that he's going into. And so in his mind, he's not being reckless. He can't eliminate the risk, but he knows exactly what it is, and he does what he can to minimise it. So reducing uncertainty about a situation and reducing uncertainty about our ability to deal with it is a really important step in being brave. And it's never too early to start boosting self-efficacy. So most young children, they're naturally brave. They're always pushing the boundaries. They're looking for ways out of their comfort zone. But we quite often mollycoddle that out of them. So I'm involved in a project with a school that takes kids on big expeditions, really big expeditions. So this summer they went to Mongolia, Kyrgyzstan and Greenland. And this is Hazel. She was one of the Greenland kids. They were crossing a glacier over the period of 3 weeks, and it's a crevasse-ridden glacier, and the thing she was terrified about was falling into a crevasse. She's 15 years old. Here she is, ice climbing out of a crevasse, something she'd been terrified about doing. She's learning here that she's much braver than she thought she was, and she's learning here that she's much more capable than she thought she was. And these sort of experiences, scary experiences, but kind of managed well, are the key to making kids braver and more confident in their abilities. If you wrap them up in cotton wool, you're teaching them to fear. You're not teaching them to be brave. So direct experiences are a really good way of learning bravery. Practice bravery, practice it every day. Another way of learning is through role models. So here is Molly Hughes. In 2012, she was one of the youngest women ever to climb Mount Everest. And this year, she climbed it again from the north side, having been up the south side in 2012. So she's the first English woman to successfully summit from both sides. And she's speaking here at the Women's Adventure Expo, which is a social enterprise in Bristol that I'm really proud to be academic advisor to. And the purpose of the expo is to empower and encourage women to have a go at adventure. And at these expo meetings, women like Molly speak to them, tell their stories. She's encouraging them, in the true sense of the word, encourage, giving courage to these women to step outside their comfort zone. And women really need this. I was at the Royal Geographical Society this weekend for an event there, and someone told me that 90% of sponsorship of expeditions goes to expeditions led by men. And part of this is that women just aren't applying for sponsorship. But part of it also, and I was very disappointed to hear from some women, is they would approach corporate sponsors who told them, we don't really want to sponsor a woman doing a dangerous thing, or our customers aren't interested in women doing this kind of thing. And frankly, guys, if you think women aren't interested in these kind of inspiring role models, you're really not paying attention. So research on bravery and fear highlights the importance of role modelling courage. Studies reveal that when we're in dangerous situations, if we see other people cracking up and being fearful, we feel fearful ourselves. But if we see other people being brave, that gives us courage. Fear and bravery are both contagious. So finally, on to value goals. It's really hard to be brave if you don't have a really good reason. Why would you risk everything for something that doesn't really matter to you? So for the people who go into extremes, what are those value goals? What are the motivations? So you'll remember Felix Baumgartner jumping from the stratosphere in 2012 as part of the Red Bull Stratos jump. Yeah, most of you probably saw that. Amazing feat. I'm not going to take anything away from him. But this man, Joe Kittinger, did the same thing 50 years before. So it's here it's August 1960, and he's just stepped out of that metal capsule, which is suspended below a helium balloon, and he is about to plummet 20 miles to the earth below. No one came close to equaling his feat until Baumgartner's Stratos jump. And Kissinger's wearing a pressure suit here because at such extreme altitudes, an unprotected body would suffer catastrophic damage. So just one of the very many hazards of jumping out of a balloon 20 miles above the earth, one of the many hazards is that the boiling point of water at 63,000 feet, which is a little over halfway up, the boiling point of water is the same as human body temperature. So without a pressure suit, imagine all of the water in your body boiling, and you get some sense of the hazards there. What Kissinger did was prove that humans could survive stratospheric conditions, which was really crucial knowledge for NASA and for the Air Force, who needed to know whether pilots could bail out at high altitude. No one had ever done it before. No one knew what would happen to him. And he wasn't after fame or fortune or even chasing records. This wasn't even an official record because of the way that they did it. He was risking death for scientific knowledge. He was risking death for a little piece of the puzzle that could one day save the life of future generations. And here is Natalie Cabrol. She's a scientist. She's passionate about understanding how organisms evolve in hostile conditions because this gives us clues as to how life might develop on other planets. But you don't find those hostile conditions in the lab. So I want you to imagine Cabrol, a few years younger than she is in this photo, going into her the office of her boss at NASA and saying, you know, Chief, I've got this great idea. I'd want to climb a volcano in South America. It's about 20,000 feet high, very, very thin air up there. And by the way, the volcano's not extinct. And there's a lake on top, and I want to dive in that lake, almost freezing temperature. Oh, there's something else I need to tell you. I'm a free diver. I dive without oxygen. So why would she do that? Well, because high altitude volcanic lakes are a great analogue for extraterrestrial conditions. So she had to become a mountaineer and a diver to study the organisms that live within them. And she actually holds a world record for high altitude free diving. And that experience, diving in that lake at 20,000 feet, ice cold and oxygen deprived, she described as the most rewarding experience of my life so far. So a passion for scientific discovery is a really powerful motivator, but other forms of passion can also be powerful. So I spoke to one woman that I met through the Adventure Expo, and she was telling about her big expedition, her big adventure, which was travelling solo around Europe. So it's not climbing Mount Everest, but it was huge for her. And I asked her why she'd done it, and she said she'd been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and she was getting very frustrated at the fact that people were stereotyping her and they were putting her in boxes. And so I said, so what actually drove you to the adventure? And she said, you know, it was rage. It was rage at what people thought about the limiting impact of my mental health condition. So it's the power of passion that drives you to take risks and dare, whether that's passion for discovery, rage at people who think you can't do it, or just excitement about what lies beyond that risky edge. It's the power of passion. So what are the lessons then for brave leaders hoping to make themselves and their teams braver? Six things. First of all, be a courageous role model. Embrace those courageous moments. When you feel fear, find ways to control it. If you don't feel brave, then pretend. There are studies out there that show that that helps. Lack of knowledge and uncertainty is a powerful barrier to bravery. So reduce uncertainty for yourself and for your team through planning, information gathering, preparation. Number three, people who have confidence in their ability, self-efficacy, are much more likely to be brave. You can build that team, that confidence in yourself and in your team by training and practicing, and as a leader, giving constructive, positive feedback. Number four, anticipatory fear holds us back from being brave. And once we get started, that fear often diminishes. So don't let people ruminate on the what-ifs that you can't control. Focus on the things that you can do. Number five, fear of failure holds us back. So remind yourself and remind your teams that failure is okay. It's part of the route to success. Moments of failure are moments for learning. And finally, number six, find the passion. Remind yourself of the motivation you have to be brave. I want to finish with this picture. It's the one I started with. A lot of people think that this is a Photoshop picture. It's not. This is astronaut Bruce McCandless in 1984 testing NASA's manned maneuvering unit for the very first time. He's floating 200 metres from the space shuttle. He's untethered. And both he and the space shuttle are hurtling around the Earth at 18,000 miles an hour. So what gives him the courage? Well, it's confidence in himself and in his team. It's the ability to focus and control fear. And it's an unwavering belief in the importance of what he's doing. This is truly bravery at the limits. Thank you.